Okay, let's begin and welcome back. A couple of housekeeping items. First of all, I don't know if Shira is on the call, so I've claimed host, so I get to play host a little bit today also. I hope that won't be too difficult. I'm going to again put the chat, the link for the source page. It's the same one as last week. And you should be able to find it there. And we're ready to start. One word of, again, if you have the ability to turn your cameras on, I get to see your cameras. It would be helpful to me. If not, I understand. But it's always nice to see people's faces and kind of talk face to face instead of sit face to box and name. That's number one. Number two, please note that I think they're starting with Chodesh. Torah Motion is running a series on Pesach. I think there's a bunch of different shiurim that are scheduled. You can take a look at their schedule. I don't have the full list, but I do know that I am scheduled to give one of the sessions. The one that I'm scheduled to give is going to interrupt our regularly scheduled program. So next Tuesday at 1 o'clock, at 1 o'clock or 12 o'clock or Israel time, whatever it is, this time slot, which was supposed to be another shiur on Daniel, is now going to be preempted by a special shiur on Pesach. So together with all of the other shiurim scheduled for Pesach, I'm going to do something for Pesach on this time slot, which is actually convenient for me because we're going to finish a unit today, and this way I don't have to start a new unit before we start Pesach, Pesach break. So that'll all work very well. So the plan is you're all welcome. Register and come back and tune in. It's a different link, so you'll have to register for it to get the new link. And then we will resume our regular Daniel schedule after Pesach, whatever that date is. Does that work for everybody? Okay, perfect. We're going to have some fun with the question. I'll already give you a prelude to what's coming next week. So you get the first teaser trailer to the shiur. There's a bunch of things we do at the Pesach Seder that are all designed. Oh, she was with us. They're all designed to. You're gonna have to claim back host because I claimed host while you weren't here. So that are all designed to raise the questions and right to get our children to ask questions. Mishum Mekara Latinok. There's a whole bunch of them. If you think about them, we'll review them next week. But think about this: if you do something just for the sole purpose of having a child ask why you do so, what are you going to answer when they ask why did you do that? And if you think the answer that I did that just so that you would ask why I did that is satisfying, and you haven't asked had that conversation with a 4-year-old in the past, so obviously we're going to have to figure out. If all these weird things that we do for the purpose of getting our children to ask questions, what are we going to answer once they ask the question? That's the general topic heading of my presentation this year. Before you came on, I mentioned I put in the plug for the whole Pesach series. So that'll take. That's I think there's a shiur. I don't know, almost every day. You're welcome
Thank
to
you. I'll
look at
post
it.
a link, and I'll post a link to the sources that your sources as well.
Thank you very much. So today's shiur is the same as last week. But Bezrat Hashem, next week's class will be a special class on Pesach. Okay, we're going to jump right in. And as we need to share screen, right. We had jumped to Perek Zion last week because we were doing the last couple of chapters on the story of Belshazzar and Daniel's review about visions in the time of Belshazzar. So we skipped. We went from chapter 5, I believe, which was the writing on the wall, to chapter 7, and then we'll do 8, and then we'll go back to 6, which is the story of Daniel and the lion's den, at another time. And in this vision of Perek Zion, Daniel has a vision himself. This is now in part 2 of the book, where it's Daniel's own visions, and he has this vision about 4 different animals that emerge from the Great Sea. They are described in detail. They are animals that don't match anything in the animal kingdom that we have, but they're part of this vision. Arba Chayot Gedolot. The first was a lion with wings of an eagle, and the wings fall off, and the lion stands on 2 feet and is given the heart of a man. Then after it comes the something that looks like a bear with bones between its teeth. The third is a looks like a leopard and a mare with wings. It has four wings, it has four heads, and it has dominion. And then after that comes a fourth animal, which is not given any sort of analogy, chaya revi'it, which is shinayim shel bazel gdolot ochelot umidaka. It looks terrible, it's devouring, it has teeth of iron, and it has 10 horns. And out of these 10 horns emerges one additional small horn, which grows both eyes and a mouth, and it begins to speak, and it begins to destroy the other horns. All of this is part of his vision. Then he questions what this is, doesn't understand, and he's told about the dominions that these animals will have, and that ultimately the Atik Yomin, the one of eternal days, he asks the angel, what does this mean? To explain this, and he says these four animals, they are four kings that will arise from the earth. They will establish kingdom over history, ad olam olamim. And then to understand what this fourth one was, and the ten horns and the little horn that emerged from it, al esra kanayim asher barosha. So he says that this one is particularly bombastic, and this little horn, and kind of go to war against all the others, until the Atik Yomin, or Tek Yamin, the one who is given ancient days, will sit in judgment. This fourth beast will be a kingdom that will be different from all of the other kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth. And these 10 horns, Esar Kinaim, Mimena HaMachut, Asra Malachim Yakumu, shall be 10 kings that shall arise. And then after them, there will be another kingdom that will be different and that will be more bombastic. And eventually, Amachut V'Ashilton V'Agdula Shal HaMalchuyot Tachat Kol HaShemayim Nitnu La'am Kedoshei Elyonim. Eventually, all kingdom, dominion, and greatness in the kingdoms will be given to the people of the Most High. And their kingdom shall be eternal. That's the vision. Okay. So it very much sounds like, feels like, and is reminiscent of Nebuchadnezzar's dream back in chapter 2. We saw the great statue with different medals that represented the various different kingdoms and the kings and that will rise and fall over the course of history until that great stone that will come and smash them all and will be given eternal kingdom. And the Mefarshim, virtually all of them, assume that this is in fact a repetition of the kind of vision we had back in chapter 2. Very similar, there's some different nuances here, but essentially of the same style. And as we move into the world of the commentaries, so just quick review, we talked about the fact that Rashi and more or less all the Mefarshim take the exact same approach that they took back in chapter 2. Namely, the first, the lion, represents the kingdom of Babel. The second, the dove, the bear, represents the kingdom of Persia. The third, which is the leopard with the four heads, represents the kingdom of Alexander the Great. And the four diadochi that emerged after his death to split the kingdom apart and to reign over various parts. And then the last one, which is the 10 horns, represents, says Rashi, Rome and the 10 Caesars who reigned over Rome until Vespasianus destroyed the temple. That is Rashi's interpretation. And for more or less, you go through the same exercise we went through back in chapter 2, which is the various interpretations of those who lived in the context of the Islamic regime and who saw the third kingdom as a combination of Greece and Rome and the fourth kingdom as Ishmael, or combination of Ishmael and Rome. And so the interpretations run the same style. However, here we have a much more complex issue. And the more complex issue is that at the end of this parak, we have a very specific chronological reference. And that is in Pasuk Chaf Hei, Udvarim Litzad Ayon Daber, he shall speak words against the One Most High. This is this little horn that will be so bombastic and chutzpahdik. Et kedoshei elyonim yaneh, v'yachshov l'shanot zman ve'et. He will seek to change the seasons and the law. Yitnu biyado ad moed moedim v'chatzi moed, until a time and times and half a time. So this last piece of this kingdom of the horns will be given only, dominion only up until moed umoedim v'chatzi moed, time and times and half a time. And this introduces to us a complexity in Sefer Daniel that is unique amongst all the books of Tanakh, in which Daniel seeks to give us specific time references to the events of his vision. And we see this as a kind of a pattern. This is the pasuk I've shifted now to the source page. This is the pasuk in Perek Zion that I just shared with you. Time, times, and half a time. Idan v'idanin uplag idan. In Perek Chet, he makes a similar statement with regards to how long will it be? Will this vision be regarding the continual burnt offering that and the appalling transgressions, and how long will they be allowed to trample upon the temple? And he said to me, Ad erev boker alpaim shloshmiot, till 2,300 evenings and mornings, and then v'nitzdak kodesh, the sanctuary will be victorious. Similarly, Daniel Perek Yud Bet, the very end of the book, we have a reference to the time of the burnt offering being taken away, Husar HaTamid, and a detestable idol being set up in the temple, V'latet Shikutz Shomem. How long will that be? 1,290 days. Ashrei HaMechakev Yagia LiYamim 1,335. Happy is the one who waits and comes to 1,335 days. And there's another vision of time, which I didn't include in this list, about the 77s and 70 weeks, which we will come to Bezrat Hashem another time. Daniel is full of dates, full of numbers, and they're all as cryptic as the next. And that's the mystery that begins to disturb the Mefarshim. What do these numbers represent? Do they actually predict when this redemption process of when the Mashiach is going to come, what Chazal referred to as the capes, the revelation of the time. Remember that Medrash by Yaakov, that Yaakov wanted to reveal the designated time of the coming of Mashiach. And the Mefarshim, virtually all of them, take the approach that these are all mysterious calculations as to when Mashiach is going to come. We just have to decipher the code. And we started that exercise, and we're going to do that today. We looked at remember that all the Rishonim are going to speak in terms of numbers of dates, years, specific years from creation. So I gave you a code, cross-reference key to biblical chronology that we talked about last week. We're not going to review that now, just to know that the key dates here are the Exodus in year 2448. The first temple is destroyed in the year 3338. And the second temple is destroyed in the year 3828. These are the differentials between each one. How those numbers are calculated, if you weren't in the class last week, I would suggest go back to that class. That's where I spent most of the time analyzing. So what do we do with this? So I'm going to go three classic approaches to the story, to these calculations and dates, and then we're going to offer a possible fourth approach. That's our goal for today. Ad erev boker alpaim shloshmiot, says Rashi, I saw a solution offered by Reb Sadya Gaon. Reb Sadya Gaon offered a specific date, ukvava, and it's already passed. Says Rashi, we have a problem. The first calculation based on this notion of erev boker alpaim shloshmiot, evening, morning, 2,300, has passed. What that calculation is very simple. I put it in a footnote. Sadya Gaon calculates 2,300 years from the Exodus, which would bring us to the year 4748, or in English years, to the year 988. Rashi lived in between 1040 and 1105. Clearly, this is not doable. And so Rashi says that there are lots of Mefarshim who offer different dates to calculate what these numbers mean. And if the time passes, then it simply means that the calculation was an error, because the calculate, right? The nevuah is correct. Our calculations can be flawed. And therefore, we shall continue to wait until the coming of the Mashiach, one calculated time after another. When the calculated time that the particular commentary comes to passes and the Mashiach has not yet come, that's how we'll know that he made a mistake. If the time that has been announced in his calculations comes and goes, then we know that the calculation is an error. So says Rashi, and virtually all the Rishonim fall in line with that same interpretation. So Rashi, therefore, himself offers a different interpretation. And then we're going to go through the exercise, a little bit of math. So hold on to your hats. Here we go. First thing we need to know, says Rashi, is what is this cryptic phrase, Idan? Idanin uplag idan, or in Hebrew, et itim v'chatzi itim, time, times, and half a time. Well, cryptic. If there was ever something cryptic, that's about as cryptic as it can be. So Rashi says, ketz satum huzeh. This is an obscure description of the end time, because all of Daniel is obscure. In fact, the closing statement in the book of Daniel is the Malach says to Daniel, "Stom advarim v'chatom," seal up these words and disguise them, hide them. In other words, he was revealed secrets that, says the Malach to Daniel, don't reveal. So you can ask the question, of course, why did he write the book? That is a question I don't have a answer to. Nonetheless, each commentary, according to his view, understood this phrase, and they've all passed. So what are we going to do with this? So I'm going to throw my hat in the ring, says Rashi, and offer the following. Remember, there are three variables here. I'm just going to go back to the numbers that Rashi is going to dance with. One is this phrase, idan, idanin, plag idan, time, times, and half a time. Another is this phrase, era boker alpaim shloshmot, 2,300. And the third is this last number at the end of Daniel of, happy is the one who waits for 1,335. Ashreha mechakel liyamim, 1,335. Says Rashi, עוד, יש לנו פתור עוד, כאשר ראיתי כתוב בשם רב סעדיה, 1,335 שנים, this 1,335 years, the numbers I inserted into the text, the numbers aren't in the original, I assume you understand that. That is referenced at the end of the book, Amor Besof HaSefer, Ashrei Mechakeh. What do I do with the R verse, time, times, and half a time? Perish HaMoed, Ad Et shnei itim v'chatzi et. This verse means until the time of 2 units and a half, 2.5 units of time has passed. Idan, idanin, v'chatzi idan. Time, 2 times, half a time. Put it together, you get 2.5. So 2.5 units of time. The question is, of course, what's a unit of time? So says Rashi, Amar Shehaitim, there's only two possibilities. Hem arbamirot ushmonim. The first possibility is 480 years. Anybody remember what 480 years is? The number of years between the Exodus and the building of the first temple. 480 years is a verse in the beginning of Sefer Malachim in Perek Vav, that the temple was built 480 years after the Exodus from Egypt. That's an explicit verse. It's one of those anchor points in biblical chronology. So Rashi says that first time is 480. Shemiyom tzitami mitzayim ad shebenivna bayit, from the Exodus until they built the temple. The second reference of time is 410. What's 410? The number of years of the first temple. Remember that Daniel is speaking during the time of the Babylonian exile. So in Rashi's estimate, he's anchoring all his dates based on his own present time frame, which is the two most significant units of time so far have been the 480 years from Exodus till temple built, and the 410 years from temple built to temple destroyed. Put them together, you get 890 years. Haray, tough, tough, tzaddik. V'od chatzi ha'et hazeh, now it was time, times, and half a time. So now half of 890 is 445, tough mem hey. Now, for those calculating in your head, 890 plus 445 is equal to 1,335, which is exactly the number of that verse in chapter 8. Chapter 9, Yamim Elef Ushlosh Melot Shloshim Chamisha, 1,335. So it comes to the same numbers. That's the beauty of Rashi's interpretation. The numbers fit exactly. They take the phrase out of chapter 7, and it fits exactly into the number in chapter 12. It's very neat. It's so compelling. Therefore, Et Elech Hashov Me'etu Saha Tamid, you have to calculate these based on the verse in chapter 12, which says that these are years from the time that the Tamid is removed. Okay, let's just go to the end of the and see that. Me'et husar ha-Tamid, v'latet shikutz mishomem, yamim, etc. This number is reference to the time that the burnt offering shall be stopped. So therefore, we should know that zevach ha-Tamid, husar sheish shanim lifnei ha-Churban, that the temple, there's a Masoret based on the Gemara in Gittin, that the Korban Tamid was stopped 6 years prior to the Korban. So 6 years prior to the Korban, if the temple, first temple was destroyed in the year 3838, which is corresponds to the year 68, 3338 is the year that they all use for the destruction of the temple, then 6 years earlier is 3822. With me? Yes, okay. V'yesh k'tzat raya b'sefer zeh v'od yesh mevi'in raya l'cheshbon zeh. There's another proof to this number. This I love. That is the gematria of Haster Astir. The gematria of Haster Astir is in gematria 1,335. If somebody wants to volunteer on the side, who's an expert in gematria, to do a quick calculation of the gematria of Haster Astir. According to Rashi, it should come to 1335. I can tell you it's not correct, but I'll let you calculate that and see how far the error is. In the meantime, summary of Rashi's calculations are that the 1335, Yamim Elef Shlosh Meot Shloshim Chamesh, you take the two times, the 480 years the Beit HaMikdash was built, the 410 years that the Beit HaMikdash stood, you combine them together, 8, itin, combined, and then chatzi et, half of it, and comes to 1,335. Add that to the year that 6 years before the temple was destroyed, and you end up with the year, didn't actually do the Hebrew dates here, but I should have, you end up with the year 1397 of the Common Era. According to Rashi, Mashiach is destined to come in or by the year 1397. Does everybody see how I got to that calculation? Rashi's famous prediction, Mashiach will come in the year 1397. Now, for Rashi, that worked very well. Why? Because when did Rashi live? Before or after the year 1397?
Before.
Right. That's all I need to know, right? The Rashi lived in the 11th century. So for Rashi, the year 1397 and the end of the 14th century is perfect. The Mashiach will come within the next couple of hundred years. It's perfect. It's very nice. It's very convenient. Ashrei ha-mechakeh, happy is the one who waits. We're almost there, says Rashi. We're just a couple of hundred years shy, and Mashiach will come. Of course, the problem is, for us, what's the problem for us? Somebody unmute and tell
Mashiach,
me.
Mashiach did not arrive yet.
1397 has come and gone.
Long ago.
No, 1397 has come and gone. So Rashi himself says, if the time of the Kedz comes and goes and Mashiach has not arrived, it means that the mistake or the error lies in the commentary. Okay, so Rashi has essentially written himself out of the script. So we move forward. Let's look at the Abarvanel. I'm skipping one very important commentary. I'm skipping him intentionally. That's the Ibn Ezra. We will, Bezrat Hashem, come back to the Ibn Ezra in chapter 8. But for now, I'm leaving the Ibn Ezra aside. Let's look at the Abarvanel. The Abarvanel wrote a very interesting sefer on Book of Daniel. It's called Ma'ayanei HaYeshua. And again, I've put the dates of all these commentaries in the beginning because it's important to know when they lived. So the Abarvanel lived between 1437 and 1508. Clearly, he knew that Rashi's commentary, that Rashi's numbers were in error because he lived more or less 50 years after the year 1397. So, well, actually 40 years exactly to his birth. A mispar hazeh, he quotes Rashi, a mispar hazeh, and then shove, it's not worth anything. We've reached that date and it hasn't helped. I apologize, I don't have an English translation to these last two sources. I'm going to translate as we go. In that year, 3828, Libriata Olam, Nechrav Bayit Sheni, that's the year that the temple was destroyed. If you add the 1,338 to the year of the temple's destruction, 3828, according to that, Mashiach should have come by the year 5163 or 1403. Let me explain what the Abarvanel has just done. The Abarvanel has taken us the same number, 1335, that Rashi used based on the end of the book. And he said, okay, if Rashi calculated that from the end of the first destruction of the temple, the end of the destruction of the first temple, let's shift gears. Let's assume for a moment that Daniel is predicting way into the future. And predicting way into the future, Rashi based on the 1335 from 6 years before the destruction of the second temple, correct? So he says, if you add 1335 to not the 6 years prior to that, but the actual year of the destruction itself, 3828, right? If you add the 1335, you come to the number 1403, even without those 6 years that Rashi took off because of the Talmud. And that didn't work either because Azman is a Chalaf, Halachlo. 1403 is almost 100 years ago, says the Abarvanel, who's writing towards the end of his life. He died in the year 1508. So almost 100 years has passed, he writes, from the year 1403 or 5163. So that whole approach isn't going to work. And then he has a pshat issue with Rashi's interpretation, but we'll leave that for now. That's irrelevant. There are many other calculations that were offered by many sages. I don't even have to mention them here, because they're all gone. They were all false. They were all disappointing. And therefore, what are we going to do? So the Abarvanel says the solution is recalculate. Okay? Recalculate. The Abarvanel is going to recalculate for us. And the first thing he's going to do, he's going to say to us, Ha'oleh al-Ruchi, it would seem to me, She'idan, this time, remember this key phrase that we're talking about, is this phrase, E'idan, idanin, beplag idan. Eight, time, itim, plural, times, and half a time. So he says, Rashi said, from one time, I got two times, then I had a half a time, so I have two and a half times the number. He says, Idan Huzman, that refers to one's unit of time. Idanin is the plural, two times, refers to an additional two times. And therefore, you and Ken, shloshazmanim v'chatzizman. It's not 2.5 times, it's 3.5 times. That's why it's written in such a cryptic way. Time, plus times, plural, minimum 2, plus half of one of those units of time. Okay, problem is, what unit of time am I multiplying? V'ha'idan huazman asher ha'tamid mikdash rishon bebinyano. It can only be, says the Abarbanel, that the unit of time here is the unit of time of the time that the first temple stood, which makes a lot of sense. If you think about the logic, if I'm going to measure history in historical terms with numbers, I'm going to take the Daniel who's living in the Churban, is living in the exile, who's living in the experience of the Babylonian exile, having suffered the destruction of the temple after 410 years, the unit of time that he's working with is that magical number, how long the temple stood, which was 410 years. Tiral is man hazeh idan. That number, 410, is called a time. The arev, the sweetness and the delicacy of the temple stood. They weren't under the subject of foreign rule. This is somewhat of a oversimplification of the time of the temple, but okay. Daniel knew this time. This was a time Daniel could work with. And all of the exiles, all the people of the exiles knew this time. It's as if to say, imagine for a moment I said that we're celebrating the State of Israel's 75th birthday. Imagine I said to you, we're going to see extraordinary things by the time the State of Israel is three times the age it is right now. You'd have a number to work with, right? Because I'm referring to something I know about right now, which is a time frame of common conversation. So common conversation, says the Abarbanel, was that the temple stood for 410 years. So he's working with that unit of number. Therefore, the Malach takes that number and multiplies it. Gimel pa'amim v'chetzi, 3.5 times 410. Somebody doing the math for me? 3.5 times 410 is equal to, somebody want to do the math? 1,435, or 1,435. Yes? Okay. Somebody have a calculator in front of them? Okay. Keep me honest, folks, as you never know what we can do with numbers. If you add that number, 1,435, to the year of the destruction of the second temple. Yes, second temple, first temple. No, first temple. First temple. No, 3828 is, what do we say? The second temple. 3828 is the second temple. If you add that number to the destruction of the second temple, which is Shenichrav Bayit Sheni, right? That's the year the second temple was destroyed. So you add 3828. Well, you add 1435 to 3828, that's when we were given over to the Romans. Yeah. Why are the Romans relevant to this conversation? Why are the Romans relevant to this conversation?
Well, they destroyed Second Beit HaMikdash.
Correct. But why would that be the vision here? What's the fourth animal?
Okay.
I always have to go back to the Perek.
The
vision is the four kingdoms: Bavel, Persia, Greece.
Oh. Where we determine Rome. Whether something else had gone wrong as a result of it having completed.
Sorry, say that again. Was that to me? No. Okay. So we'll go on. So the whole vision is about the four animals, the last one representing Rome. Rome/Ishmael, we can argue. Therefore, you add the number to 3828, Yeh Zman Haketz V'Sof HaGalut Bezvat Hashem, the end of the exile and the end of the, and the time of the coming of Mashiach will be, please God, in the year 5263, aka in this year of the English calendar, 1503. And he's going to make this number fit all the other visions that will come down the pipeline. In other words, whereas Rav Sadia Gaon said the year in question was the year 998, Rashi said the year in question was the year 1397, Abarbanel says that can't be, those years have all come and gone. The year must be 1503. Okay, that's how we come to the number. You have to take the key number, which is 410, and multiply it not by 2.5, but by 3.5. Idanin, upelag, uplag idan, time, times, and half a time. You add that to the end of the second temple, which is the year 3028, lineage 28. You come to the year 5263, which in the English calendar is the year 1503. Does that number work for the Abarbanel? Yes. When did the Abarbanel pass away? In the year 1508. So when he wrote this, which is just prior to that, right? It's quite possible that he was anticipating that this will happen within a very short period of time. 1503 notice is also, interestingly enough, only a, 20 years after the expulsion from Spain? Right? 1492? So it's a, 1492, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 years. 11 years after the expulsion from Spain, very powerful, compelling link, says the Abarbanel, that is his interpretation. Of course, for us, it's not going to work because
it's already passed.
Came and went.
Came and went. But I find the pattern fascinating that each reinterpretation places the date for the coming of the Mashiach somewhere within the next short to midterm time frame from when the commentary lived. It just, it's a fascinating observation. All right, so let's try one more. Let's move forward to the Malbim. The Malbim lived in the 19th century, 1809 to 1879. And the Malbim saw all of this. He saw Rashi, he saw the Sajagon, he saw the Abarbanel. What is he going to do? Achash, Satam, Velo, Piresh, Eze, Idan. What Idan are we talking about? What time are we talking about in this commentary, in this vision? Vedai, Kiven, El, Et, Yadua. He had to have been talking about some time unit that was known at the, to Daniel. And that can either be, O Arba Miot Shana, O Taf Yud Shana. Can either be 400 years or 410 years. What was 400 years? Why would that be the unit of time in question?
The Jews were in Mitzrayim.
That's the number of years we were in Egypt. So I can either work with that unit of time or the number of years of the first temple, which is 410. And that all the other Rishonim understood as well, he says. Except, Hem Pirshu Peleg Idan. The earlier commentaries, the mistake they made was when they interpreted we have time, times, and half a time. Their understanding of half a time was half of one of these units. So if these units were either 400 or 410 or 480, half of one of them was added to the conversation. Says the Malbim, oh, that's the mistake. These are Kalukol HaKetzin, they were too early. Ameti sheperush pelag idan is chatzi zman hakolel shel idan veidanin. That half a time is half of the combined years of the first idan and chatzi and idanin. So I have time, times, meaning three times, and now I have half of the total. So he says, okay, let's work it through. If we work with 400 years as the unit of time, if that's the case, then 3 times 400 is 1,200. And half of 1,200 is 600. So you have to add 1,200 plus the 600, and you end up with 1,800 years. Now the 1,800 years, you're going to calculate from the destruction of the temple. So 3828 plus 1,800 is going to come to the year 5628. Yegi Azman Shnat Taf Resh Chaf Chet. And that'll come to the year 1868. Only problem is, but Malbim recognized a problem in his calculation, which is?
It passed.
Yeah, the Malbim wrote this after 1868. Not only that, this time has already doesn't match anything that will come later in the book. So in order to make all these calculations come to the same focal point, he says, therefore, he has no choice but to take the more complex mathematical formula of 410 years rather than 400 as the base unit. You times that by 3, you get to 1230. You add the half of 1230, which is 615. So far, everybody with me? Yes? I'm doing it quickly, but hope you're all still with me. Sach HaKol comes to a total of 1,845 years. I took 410. I multiplied that by 3. I got 1230, and then it took half of that total, came to 615, and add them together, I get 1845. And here's the mathematical formula if somebody is so inclined. The Yegi Zman HaKetz, if that's the case, what is the Zman HaKetz? From the destruction of the temple, 3828, add 1845, I come to the year 5763, which in the English calendar is the year 1913. Now, if anybody's wondering what happened in the year 1913, we'll come back to that Bezrat Hashem in a couple of shiurim. And that works perfectly with everything else in the Sefer Daniel. V'achar shezman satum zmanim hayiduim b'imei Daniel hem 2,400 tav yud. Okay, that's the rest of it is not our issue for now. But that's his calculation. His calculation is exactly as I described. The year 1913 of the Common Era. Now, for us to say that Mashiach has not yet come in the year 1913 is also a foregone conclusion. So we're still stuck with this question of what does all this mean? The only thing I will tell you is that 1913 has a certain historical significance, but we'll talk about what the historical significance is in another context. So what do we do? I ran through these numbers, but you get the same drift of what they're all trying to do, which is take this time times and half a time and match it up with the Nevuah about the four kingdoms and figure out if they're taking us all the way to Rome, the destruction of the Second Temple, starting from there, how many years do I have to move forward until I have this 8 Ketz? And I end up with a mystery. Okay. We could stop here and stop at 15 minutes early for a change, which would be really quite astounding. But that's not going to happen because there's another possibility.
Can we, that 5763 was not 1913 because now is 578.
Sorry, that's a misprint. 5673. Sorry, that's a typo. It's 1,673. That's a little bit of a typing. My fingers get ahead of themselves sometimes. I apologize, but this number is correct. Okay, so what do we do with all of this? So I want to introduce you to another approach altogether. It is actually an approach we have seen, we have discussed back in chapter 2. And we're going to reintroduce it now. And we're going to see it again in chapter 8. And we're going to see it again in chapters 10, 11, and 12. And that is all the Rishonim that we've identified till now, including the Abarbanel, including the Ibn Ezra, who I haven't included in this list for now, all take the assumption that Daniel's vision takes us from Daniel's time to the end of time. But if you remember our discussion of the word kitz, or the word achrit hayamim, or at the end of days, or the ending of days, the notion that Daniel saw, or that any of the Nevi'im saw, a vision that was thousands of years into the future, is very complicated. I'm going to stop sharing for a second so I can see the screen. Yeah, it's very complicated. The notion that Daniel's sitting there in the Babylonian exile and talking about events that haven't happened yet, but not just haven't happened yet, they haven't happened yet for thousands of years, has no meaning to the people he's talking to. Yeshayahu to describe a coming of Mashiach as an event that will take place in thousands of years has no meaning to the people he's talking to. So we introduced the possibility that the Nevi'im spoke in short-term visions, not long-term visions. And that only because the fulfillment of that Nevuah didn't take place in the way in which it was originally predicted or anticipated because of our own mistakes, therefore the prophecy had to get pushed further down the pipeline. Talked about this back in chapter 2. I want to share with you an example, okay, of such an interpretation. If you'll forgive me, this one's not on the source page. And the reason it's not on the source page is because I only found it subsequent to this source page preparation, so I didn't want to have to redo it. So it's here in Sepharia. If anybody's looking for it, Sepharia is certainly accessible. You'll see it. It's in a book called Sefer HaIkarim, written by Rav Yosef Albo. Rav Yosef Albo was a 15th century philosopher and writer. He wrote a book called The Book of Principles in response to the 13 Principles of Faith of the Rambam. And he talks about lots of different things. And there in this chapter, he talks about the possibility about, he's talking about prophecy in general. How far into the future did the Nevi'im see? Now he quotes an interpretation which he rejects. I'm not so interested in why he rejects this interpretation because he rejects it on technical, textual reasons. I'm more interested in the concept of what he is suggesting. And who he's quoting it is less relevant even. But here he writes, this is in Ma'amar Dalid, Perak Mem Dalid, fourth essay, chapter 42. V'chein, and you have it in English as well. V'chein katav harav Chaim Galipa. Similarly, this interpretation that we're about to reflect is offered by Chaim Galipa. Who is Chaim Galipa? Chaim Galipa, and I actually, you can look him up, he's not hard to find, was a Spanish rabbi in the 14th century, and he quotes this letter that he wrote, that says, listen carefully, Yikol nevuotav shel Daniel, all of Daniel's prophecies, hayu al bayit sheni bilvad, never take us past the time frame of Second Temple period. And all of the phrases that appear now in the text, such as L'kadishel yonin yivla v'yizbor l'shnia zimnin v'dat v'yityavim v'yadei ad idan v'idanin upalig idan, all of these phrases, the words of Daniel, he shall wear out the saints of the Most High, he shall think to change the seasons of the Lord, they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and half a time, refers to Akol Ne'emar al Antiochus. And Daniel never sees past Antiochus and the Hasmonean revolt and the Hasmonean rebellion. And that's exactly what he says, that the malchus that we're talking about, that will come and will remain for eternity, v'yikablun malchuta kadisha elyonin, God will give them dominion. Amar ki ne'mar al ha-chashmonaim. Sometimes it's easier to believe something when you see it black and white. Okay, so now you see it black and white. There was such a Rishon who said that the entire book of Daniel is about Bayit Sheni, and that the vision here is about Antiochus. How do we get to Antiochus? So remember, we have to go back to the text itself. The story here is, I'm going to stop sharing for a second. The story here is about four animals and what those animals represent. And in the language of the Rishonim, we're going to do the same exercise that we did back in chapter 2. In the language of the Rishonim, there were malchiyot, there were kingdoms. But what if they're not kingdoms, but rather kings? And if they're kings and not kingdoms, let's work this through. The first is a lion with wings of an eagle, loses his wings, is given a heart of man, and stands on 2 feet. Does anybody know?
Oh, the wires you got to take care of.
Sorry, I'm just going to mute all, and you're welcome to unmute as you wish. We know of a lion or of an animal that was given the heart of a man and stood on 2 feet. Is that not reminiscent of Nebuchadnezzar's story? Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar. It's a classic, perfect example to Nebuchadnezzar. The bear, a little more complicated, the bear, because the bear, we don't really know much. If Nebuchadnezzar is the lion, then who is the bear? Evil Merodach is the second king of Babel. If Evil Merodach is the second king of Babel, we don't know a lot about him. He's not mentioned in many places in Tanakh. The only place he's ever mentioned is that he has a meal together with Yehoiachin when he takes Yehoiachin out of jail. So really, the only thing we know about him is that he eats. That's the only thing that's said about him. But it's not impossible to assume that a good description for him would be a bear with meat caught between his teeth, which is what the bear is with the three bones between his teeth. Not an impossible description. I don't have much to add to it. The third, on the other hand, which is the Namer, the leopard. Now, this leopard is interesting because, right, what's the description of the leopard?
Fast.
Fast. So here's how Chazal saw the leopard, interestingly. Be strong as a lion, as a leopard, and then other animals as well. And in addition to being strong as a leopard, the other characteristic of the leopard, says the Mishnah Perkei Avot, is havi az panim. Hu haya omer az panim legeinom, boshet panim legan Eden. Somebody who is arrogant is headed for Gan Eden. Headed for Gehenna. The notion of az kinamer is a combination of strength and az panim, which is arrogance.
Also fearless.
Fearless, okay.
Fearless.
But az panim is... And that's exactly the description of Belshazzar. The chutzpah, the arrogance of Belshazzar is off the charts. To take the vessels of the temple of Yerushalayim, something his grandfather never even did not have the audacity to do, even though he destroyed the temple. He respected the vessels of the temple. Belshazzar takes the vessels of the temples and he drinks out of them. Now, in historical terms, in chronological terms, it hasn't happened yet. Because this, the Nebuah of Daniel, is in year 1 of Belshazzar. And that story that I just referred to is in year 3. Okay, we'll come back to that in a second. But if the three kings referred to here are the lion, the bear, and the leopard, are Nebuchadnezzar, Evil Merodach, and Belshazzar, who or what is the fourth? To whom does Belshazzar fall? Whom does the kingdom of
Persia, Paras.
Persia. And Persia, as a description of Persia, of the next kingdom and the horns of Persia, the horns that emerged, the 10 horns. So you can argue on how to describe the Persian kingdoms that will appear in the course of history. There's something to be said for the fact that the classic interpretation of the kings of Persia are, in fact, that there are 10 main kings of Persia. There's a few others as well. But more or less, you could argue that 10 is a good number to describe the horns or the kings of Persia. It's not an impossible task. The little horn that emerges and that conquers the rest could be a reference to Alexander the Great. And ultimately, there's nothing in this book that will take us past a vision of the rise of Alexander and the rise of Greece that will take down, eventually, take down Persia. That's the whole message of Daniel. Daniel, back in chapter 2, was talking about the fact that Babylon will fall to Persia, but Persia itself shouldn't get too arrogant because their days will also be numbered. They will be taken down by Alexander the Great. We'll see this very clearly in Sefer Daniel. We'll see it in Perek Chet. Whoops, sorry. Yeah, we'll see it in Perek Chet in several references, but in Perek Chet he talks about Tzvir Ha'izim Gdil Ad Ma'od. This young goat magnified himself greatly, and when he was strong, Nishbera HaKeren Agdolah, the great horn was broken, and out of it came Chazut Arba Tachteha, referring to the death of Alexander the Great, and four kingdoms that will emerge out of it, and one will be younger than the other, and where they will go, etc. But we'll see, he mentions Daniel specifically, more than anything else. We'll talk about, looking for the reference, in chapter 8, where... I had written it down as a cross reference point, where he talks specifically about the rise of Greece. Sorry, that's a long time. Let's do that again. My apologies. That Zephyr HaSeir, this young ram with the horn that will, between its eyes, Melech Yavan, is the king of Greece. V'akeren Agdala Sheben Einav Hu HaMelech HaMishon. And this great horn between its eyes is the first kingdom. V'anishberet V'tamon Ha'ar B'tachta, and out of this king of Greece shall come four other kingdoms. He says it explicitly. I don't need to interpret chapter 8. Chapter 8 is explicitly about Greece. So if that's as far as Yechezkel's vision goes, then I understand what's happening here. Yirmiyahu spoke about three kings of Persia, of Babel. V'avdu oto v'et beno v'et ben beno. Three kings of Babel. And then Babel will fall to Persia. And the whole purpose of the message of this Nevuah is to know that even Persia, its days are also numbered. 10 horns, 10 kingdoms. But then, Alexander the Great is on the horizon. Alexander the Great will take him down. And then what will happen? They'll also come. They'll be more arrogant than the rest of them. There'll be decrees against the Jews. There'll be decrees against the law, says Daniel. That's a reference to Antiochus. And eventually the kingdom that will emerge as the kingdom of the Hashmonaim. And were we to have taken the rebellion of Hashmonaim in the direction it was intended to be, says Daniel, that's as far as he saw as the possibility to restore Jewish sovereignty to the land of Israel. And from that perspective, here's the takeaway of all of this. Chapter 7, this vision of Daniel has one message. Nebuchadnezzar, Vilmudadach, Belshazzar, the three kingdoms, the three animals, they will all fall to the fourth. Unprecedented. It doesn't have an animal associated with it. It doesn't have a named animal because it hasn't happened yet. The other three kings have all happened, so they have associated animals with them. The fourth hasn't happened yet. So it's this unknown animal with 10 horns. A scary beast. It will take down Belshazzar. That's year one of Belshazzar. That's year one. One of the interesting questions I asked, and with this we'll conclude, one of the interesting questions we asked when we read chapter five, again, the chapters are out of order. When year three of Belshazzar, and Daniel is invited to interpret the writing on the wall of Belshazzar's feast, and he walks into the chambers for the meeting of Belshazzar for the first time, and he's angry at him, and he's criticizes him, and he's disrespectful to him, and he calls Belshazzar an arrogant grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar at least had respect for God. He has nothing. And he interprets right away the writing on the wall as Belshazzar is going to die. And we ask the question, how is he so sure that that was the message of the Nevoah? He just walked in and he saw it and boom, he knew what it was talking about. The answer is very simple. The answer is that chapter 5 of Daniel is taking place 2 years after chapter 7, meaning he's already had two prophecies about the fall of Babel to the hands of Persia. The first one was in chapter 1, the first year, chapter 7, first year of Belshazzar. He has his vision, and in this vision, he's shown clearly the three kings of Babel, Nebuchadnezzar, Evil-Merodach, Belshazzar, the leper, the arrogant, fearless king who has the audacity to use the temple vessels, who falls to the animal who arising out of the sea with the 10 horns that nobody can yet identify. He knows exactly what's going to happen to Belshazzar. And so when he walks into the temple chambers, to the palace chambers, and he sees the writing on the wall, he's already armed because he knows the answer. And the answer is that this is a prophecy about Belshazzar. All right. With that, we will conclude today's shiur. I will stay on for questions that people have. I appreciate your patience with taking us to the end of the time. Mizvat Hashem. Next week, as I said, we'll have a special shiur on Pesach at this time slot, but you have to register separately. It's a different registration. And we will continue and resume our discussion of Persia, Babel, Persia, and the end of the book of Daniel, Bezrat Hashem, after Pesach. With that, I will open the floor to questions. Abasha, you were first.
May I speak?
Yes, please.
I would like to reinforce you yourself earlier in this series asked the question, where was Daniel all this time? What was he doing in Shushan?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, he was working for the Persians and the Medes. We forget how history unfolded. Nineveh was destroyed by the Assyrians. Nineveh was destroyed by a coalition of Chaldeans, the ancestors of Nebuchadnezzar, Persians, and Medes. It's Nebuchadnezzar who rises above the partners of his father and his grandfather and basically dominates everybody. But as he passes away, the Persians and the Medes in different settings are active. The Greeks are also active. Yes. Solon is in -640. The Greeks are rising. And during the Persian empires of Cyrus and so on, there are battles between the Persians and the Greeks. Major and famous. Yes. Daniel is in the middle of all of this diplomacy. Yes. He's there. So, of course, he knows about it. He understands how the geopolitics is unfolding and is going to unfold. So it's not surprising that his real life knowledge enters into his subconscious.
100%. I agree with you 100%. It's a fascinating story of Daniel. And you see it when you start to uncover the mysteries. For some reason, I don't have an answer to this question, but for some reason, the Mefarshim all took a very different approach to the question of Daniel's prophecies. But based on what we're suggesting here, and I think that there are some contemporary scholars who write this up, Medan wrote it up in his Sefer and Daniel, and you see it in Sefer Karim, that this was always an undercurrent of understanding that Daniel's nevuah, Daniel is active, Daniel is seeing the hands of the political arms moving around, all the Nevi'im did, And this is they're offering their prophetic divine inspiration mode, vision as to what interpretation as to what is going on at that time. And certainly I think I would agree with you. I think that the Daniel's visions are about Persia and Greece. We'll enter into that conversation. And certainly that's part of the story. Okay.
You've also answered the question about that you just asked in your previous series on Midrashim.
Yes.
The Rishonim are bound by the book Seder Olam. But we in the Torah in Motion have heard several shiurim from Rabbi Liebtag about Seder Olam and how that book unfolded and where it came from. And the Rishonim are bound by that book.
There's various ways to phrase it, but it certainly had a large influence on their mindset. Okay, any other questions?
Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
All right, wonderful. Have a wonderful day, everybody, and we will see you, Bezrat Hashem, next week, I hope. Shira, they're all yours.
Thank you so much. We'll see you starting tomorrow afternoon for the Pesach series. If anyone has any questions, please email me at info@torahinmotion.org. Next week, Rabbi Shulman told you he will.